This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Phenomena: The Secret History of the U.S. Government's Investigations into Extrasensory Perception and Psychokinesis. Written by Annie Jacobson. Read by the author. Dedication for Kevin, Finley, and Jet. There are but two powers in the world, the sword and the mind. In the long run, the sword is always beaten by the mind. Napoleon Bonaparte. There are two ways to be fooled. One is to believe what isn't true. The other is to refuse to believe what is true. Soren Kierkegaard. Prologue. This is a book about scientists and psychics with top secret clearances. It is about the U.S. government's decades-long interest in anomalous mental phenomena, including extrasensory perception, ESP, psychokinesis, PK, map dowsing, and other forms of divination, all disciplines the scientific community rejects as pseudoscience. Across recorded history, these disciplines have been called magical, mystical, supernatural, and occult. Today, they are called paranormal. Those who practice them have been lionized, vilified, and burned at the stake. And then, just a few years after the end of World War II, the U.S. government determined anomalous mental phenomena to be effective military and intelligence tools and began to investigate their possible use in classified operations. This book tells the story of this post-war endeavor and its continuation into the modern era. The real action began in 1972 when a small group of promising young scientists was approached by the Central Intelligence Agency to embark upon a research program involving psychics or, quote, sensitives. The work took place at Stanford Research Institute, the second largest Defense Department-funded independent research facility in the nation. The CIA challenged the scientists to first determine whether extrasensory perception, the ability to perceive things by means other than the five known senses, and psychokinesis, the ability to perturb matter with the mind, could be demonstrated and repeated in the laboratory. If so, the CIA wondered, how might these disciplines be best deployed against the enemy to win the Cold War? The results of the CIA program were spectacular. A large body of reliable experimental evidence points to the inescapable conclusion that extrasensory perception does exist as a real phenomenon, the CIA concluded in 1975. Focusing on the results, the military and the intelligence services wanted in. This included the Navy, the Air Force, the Army, including its Intelligence and Security Command, and the Development and Readiness Command, the Coast Guard, the Defense Intelligence Agency, the National Security Agency, the Drug Enforcement Administration, the U.S. Customs Service, the Secret Service, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Over time, numerous presidents, congressmen, and members of the National Security Council were briefed. When a theoretical understanding of the phenomena could not be found, grave tensions arose. In the post-war age of advancing technology, science has taken an aggressively hostile attitude toward supernatural or paranormal beliefs. Extrasensory perception and map dowsing are just modern names for divination, the practice of seeking knowledge of the future or the unknown by supernatural means. Psychokinesis was based upon a proto-scientific tradition, not unlike alchemy, the fabled supposition that using magic, man could affect matter. How could the U.S. government condone such things? In 1942, Dr. Gertrude Schmeidler, an experimental psychologist with a PhD from Harvard, conducted an experiment on the subject of anomalous mental phenomena with psychology students at City University of New York. In her questionnaire, she explored individuals' beliefs about ESP and PK. Her analysis of the data led her to create the term sheep to refer to individuals who were confident about the possible reality of ESP and PK, and goats to refer to those who doubted the existence of any so-called anomalous mental phenomena. This explicit difference between believers and disbelievers of mental phenomena has existed in the upper echelons of the U.S. military and intelligence communities since World War II. This book tells their story. The sheep-goat divide also exists across America, but with a clear minority of goats. Gallup polls and Pew Research Center studies reveal that a majority of Americans alive today harbor paranormal beliefs. 73% say they have had a supernatural or paranormal experience, and 55% believe in psychic or spiritual healing. Many Americans also believe in extrasensory perception or telepathy, 41%, believe that extraterrestrials have visited Earth, 29%, or say they've seen a ghost, 18%. A minority, 27%, do not believe in anything supernatural. This group includes scientific skeptics, who are also an important part of this story. Were the government's psychics gifted seers or skilled magicians? And are the scientists who studied them, many of whom continue to study these phenomena today, on the brink of discovery? Are they modern-day scientific revolutionaries akin to Galileo, Louis Pasteur, and Madame Curie, each of whom solved scientific mysteries that baffled scientists for millennia? Or is ESP and PK research a fool's errand, nothing more? How do scientists, people of reason, approach such enigmatic subject matter? And what about the psychics themselves? Who were the individuals hired by the U.S. government for these top-secret programs? And how do they explain their military and intelligence work? To research and report this book, I interviewed 55 scientists and psychics who worked on the government programs, including the core members of the original group from Stanford Research Institute and the CIA, the core group on the military side, defense scientists, former military intelligence officers, and government psychics, physicists, biologists, neurophysiologists, cyberneticists, astrophysicists, a general, an admiral, a Nobel laureate, and an Apollo astronaut. These are their stories. Part 1. The Early Days. The cause is hidden, the effect is visible to all. Ovid. Chapter 1. The Supernatural. Supernatural, unable to be explained by science or the laws of nature, of, relating to, or seeming to come from, magic, a god, etc. Merriam-Webster Dictionary. It was May 10, 1941, a day during World War II remembered in the history books for its bizarre links to the supernatural. Rudolf Hess, the deputy Führer of the Third Reich, woke up in his villa in the Munich suburb of Harlaching and, on the advice of his astrologer, chose this day to make his secret move. The six planets were in Taurus, and the moon would be full, the star chart allegedly said. Hess ate breakfast, had a brief conversation with his wife, and asked his driver to take him to the Messerschmitt aircraft facility in Augsburg. Shortly before 6 p.m., he climbed into a BF-110 fighter bomber and flew north. Flying low so as to avoid radar, Hess made his way down the Rhine River, across the Dutch coast, out over the North Sea, and toward Scotland. Roughly 5.5 hours after taking off, he bailed out of his aircraft and parachuted into a field at Floor's farm, near Eaglesham, a village south of Glasgow. His intention, Hess later said, was to make his way to Dungavel Castle and barter an alliance with England, using as an intermediary the Duke of Hamilton. Instead, the deputy Führer of the Third Reich was arrested and taken into custody. The interrogation that followed remains classified by British intelligence until 2041, but stories and theories about what really happened abound. Had Hitler's obsessively loyal second-in-command really betrayed the Nazi cause on the advice of an astrologer? Or had British intelligence constructed an elaborate web of deception to catch Hess, using his belief in the supernatural as bait? Years later, while serving a life sentence in Spandau prison, Hess allegedly revealed his motivation to Albert Speer, the Reich's former Minister of Armaments and War Production. Hess assured me, in all seriousness, that the idea had been inspired in him in a dream by supernatural forces, Speer wrote in Inside the Third Reich. Two of Hess's personal astrologers, Karl Kraft and Ernst Schulz-Strauthaus, were reported to have constructed the star charts that aided Hess in believing the 10th of May to be cosmically suited for his rogue flight. But there exists another version of the story, one that was revealed by the British Broadcasting Corporation in 2002. Britain's most famous witch, a woman by the name of Sybil Leake, had been recruited by British intelligence to provide phony horoscopes for the Germans who believed in astrology, according to the BBC. She apparently wrote a chart which convinced the Nazi Rudolf Hess to fly to England, where he was captured. In other words, Leake's star charts were instruments of black propaganda, inserted into the deputy Führer's inner circle to influence his behavior and help foster certain beliefs. Mum stayed silent about the Hess affair all her life, says her son, Julian Leake, a Florida resident. It's still officially classified, and the individual who revealed the story in 2002 has moved to South America and apparently doesn't answer email. To the Third Reich, Rudolf Hess's rogue flight was a supreme embarrassment. Adolf Hitler declared Hess legally insane and responded with Special Action Hess, the mass arrest of more than 600 astrologers, fortune tellers, clairvoyants, faith healers, and other German practitioners of the supernatural or the occult. Artifacts of divination, including tarot cards, scrying mirrors, and crystal balls, were confiscated, as were entire libraries of mystical texts. The circulation of all occult literature was forbidden, wrote Wilhelm Wolff, an astrologer ensnared in Special Action Hess. A decree was issued making it illegal to predict future events, the divination of the present or the past, and all other forms of revelation not based on natural processes of perception, to include the reading of cards, the casting of horoscopes, the explanation of stars, and the interpretation of omens and dreams. Practitioners of magic, including Wolf, were interrogated by agents of the Gestapo, and many were sent to concentration camps. Meanwhile, inside the Third Reich, reliance upon the occult continued, not on the orders of Adolf Hitler, but because Heinrich Himmler, Reichsführer SS, and the man Time magazine called the police chief of Nazi Europe, relied upon the supernatural as a power source himself. At least one account suggests Hitler was embarrassed by Himmler's belief system. "What nonsense," the Führer told Albert Speer, as recounted in Inside the Third Reich. "Here we have at last reached an age that has left all mysticism behind it, and now he, Himmler, wants to start that all over again. We might just as well have stayed with the church." In a post-war account by Wilhelm Wolff, Himmler's personal astrologer, astrology was privilegium singularum. It is not for the broad masses. For the Reich to control the war message, explained Wolff, powerful belief systems that lay outside the Nazi creed needed to be curtailed, but not entirely. The Nazis' head of foreign intelligence, SS Brigadefuhrer Walter Schellenberg, made an important point to Wolff about the power of mystical belief systems. They were a suitable vehicle for the propagation of political concepts and for the political control of a nation, Schellenberg said, meaning astrology could be used for great effect in a propaganda campaign. The same kind of manipulation was occurring in the United States. In the summer of 1941, a German-born Hungarian named Louis de Waal was preparing for a speech at the annual convention of the American Federation of Scientific Astrologers in Cleveland, Ohio. De Waal, a plump, bespectacled British citizen, was one of the highest-profile astrologers in the Western world. His admirers in London included Lord Halifax, who was Britain's foreign secretary, and the Duke of Alba, the ambassador from Spain. In honor of the astrology convention that year, the Cleveland News profiled de Waal in its front page under the banner, "Astrology Has Too Many Quacks." De Waal's mission in America was to remove the occult stigma from stargazing and to elevate it into the realm of astrophilosophy, he said. War was raging across Europe, and in de Waal's syndicated American column, Stars Foretell, emphasis was always on the Nazi threat. "Hitler's chief jackal is moving into the house of violence," he predicted. "Seer sees plot to kill Hitler." Starting in June 1941, just 1 month after the Hess affair, de Waal's predictions became unusually specific, and things he predicted started to come true. "A strong collaborator of Hitler, who is neither German nor a Nazi, will go violently insane," he foretold. "He will be in South or Central America, probably near the Caribbean Sea." 3 days later, U.S. news wires reported that the Vichy High Commissioner of the French West Indies, Admiral Georges Robet, had gone crazy and had to be restrained by staff. The New York Post reported that newspaper editors across America besieged de Waal with requests for exclusive stories. As de Waal's popularity escalated to meteoric heights, the Federal Communications Commission made a bold move. In August 1941, it lifted its long-standing ban against astrologers and aired an exclusive interview with the man hailed the modern Nostradamus. Then, for the first time in U.S. history, an astrologer was filmed for a U.S. newsreel. On August 28th, Pathé News released the newsreel's first plunge into prophecy with a nationwide audience of 39 million sitting as judge, jury, and witness, declared a press release issued by de Waal's manager. Except none of it was true. De Waal's successful American career was a product of British intelligence, and his so-called manager was none other than the spymaster Sir William Stevenson, a man whom Winston Churchill famously called intrepid. SS Brigadefuhrer Walter Schellenberg was correct when he stated that astrology was a vehicle for the propagation of political concepts. Louis Dewall was a committed astrologer, but he also worked for British intelligence through its operational arm in America, the British Security Coordination Office. According to Dewall's declassified intelligence file, his columns, the interviews, and the predictions were all part of an elaborate black propaganda campaign designed to organize American public opinion in favor to aid Britain. Even the American Federation of Scientific Astrologers and its 1941 convention had been fabricated by MI6. The way it worked was masterful. The British spy agency first fed information to Dewall, which he would write up in his column, Stars Foretell. The British spy agency then fed the bogus information to the U.S. press, which, unable to fact-check with the Reich, the press would report as real. For example, the Vichy High Commissioner of the French West Indies never went insane. According to the CIA's Office of the Historian, Dewall's handler worked with U.S. Spy Chief Colonel William Donovan to coordinate and oversee U.S. intelligence collection and analysis efforts. This before the Office of Strategic Services, precursor to the CIA, even existed. British intelligence believed England needed America to join the war in Europe in order for the Allied forces to beat the Nazis. Dewall's phony predictions were intended to help sway public opinion away from the prevailing U.S. isolationist views. The ruse was effective. In one declassified memo, Stevenson wrote of Dewall, "An ever-growing audience is becoming convinced of his supernatural powers." 3 months later, the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor and the U.S. declared war on Japan. On December 11th, Hitler declared war on the United States. America had entered World War II, and it was time for Louis Dewall to head home to England. For the next few years, Dewall was used by the Allies as a countermeasure to Heinrich Himmler's use of astrology and the occult. Under the direction of master propagandist Sefton Delmer, Dewall wrote seemingly authentic astrology charts that predicted the demise of certain Nazi admirals and generals, and stated that Hitler would be betrayed by his inner circle. These fake star charts and horoscopes were included in near-perfect replicas of a banned German astrological magazine called Zenit, to be smuggled into Germany for underground distribution. The idea was to make it look as if Zenit was being secretly published in Germany by German occultists working in defiance of the astrology ban. Instead, the counterfeit magazines were seized by the Gestapo in the port city of Stettin, as detailed by Wilhelm Wolff in his post-war memoir, Zodiac and Swastika. Occult interests in the public domain are, for the most part, a leisure pursuit. When entwined with the Nazis' national security apparatus, they became potent and consequential. As Reichsfuhrer SS, Heinrich Himmler promoted quasi-science projects that helped foster the myth of the superior German Übermensch, or Superman. Himmler had been fascinated with the occult since his college days, and when he became a Nazi Party district leader in 1925, he hired a 66-year-old retired army colonel named Karl Maria Villigut to advise him on these matters. Villigut, an expert in runes and Teutonic symbols, he designed the SS Death's Head ring, Totenkopfring, was a seer or medium who claimed to be able to channel a tribe of ancient Aryans from AD 1200. Elevated to the position of SS Brigadefuhrer, Villigut remained on Himmler's personal staff until SS intelligence officers discovered that between the wars in 1923, Villigut had been committed to a mental institution and declared legally insane. In 1936, he was removed from the SS command structure, but Himmler continued to meet with him privately until at least 1941, as indicated in Himmler's diaries, which were captured by the Allies after the war. By the time Villigut was removed, Himmler had already created a vast Nazi science academy called Das Annenerbe, or the Institute for Research and Study of Heredity, of which he was president and overlord. The mission of Annenerbe, according to Allied intelligence, was to prove that the Nazi ideology was directly descended from ancient Teutonic culture and was therefore superior to all others. To demonstrate this link, Himmler leaned on the mystical and the occult. Annenerbe scientists were dispatched across the continents to excavate prehistoric sites attached to mystical and supernatural ideas. From Istanbul to Iraq, they searched the globe for lost lands like Atlantis and fabled items like the Holy Grail and the Lance of Destiny, the spear said to have pierced Christ in the ribs as he hung on the cross. On Himmler's orders, SS officers scoured Germany's occupied territories, raiding libraries of the occult and looting artifacts related to magic. Entire museum collections of mystical texts in Poland, Ukraine, and Crimea were crated up for Annenerbe possession. Among the items said to be most coveted by Himmler were artifacts of ancient Germanic magic that had miraculously survived 3 centuries of witch hunts. The Annenerbe was vast and well-funded. It had 50 subsidiary branches covering broad natural science fields such as archaeology, geology, and astronomy. But it also operated highly specialized divisions, like one for geochronology, the dating of rock formations and geological events, and speleology, the study and exploration of caves. One branch, called Survey of the So-Called Occult Sciences, Überprüfung der sogenannten Geheimwissenschaften, was where research on extrasensory perception, astrology, map dowsing, spirit channeling, and other forms of anomalous mental phenomena and divination was pursued. And it was from the official Annenerbe documentation on these unusual subjects, captured separately by the United States and the Red Army, that the psychic arms race between the Soviet Union and the United States first got underway. Now it was July 1945 and World War II was over in Europe. The Nazis had been defeated, their ideas vanquished. Some 50 million people were dead. But between the Americans and the Soviets, former allies, the competition over the spoils of war had only just begun. The end of World War II marked the beginning of a new war called the Cold War, and with it would come an arms race of colossal proportions. During World War II, the Nazis had managed to create some of the most technologically advanced weapons in the world. That they mixed magic and the supernatural with science and technology was, in 1945, only vaguely understood. But the Reich's supernatural secrets would soon become part of the Cold War arms race. For 10 weeks now, the Russians had ruled Berlin. Members of an elite U.S. scientific intelligence effort called Operation Alsace had been trying to gain access to a bombed-out villa in Dahmelin, a formerly affluent suburb where numerous Nazi science institutes once stood. The villa in question was located at 16 Pucklerstrasse, and the Gestapo scientists had all cleared out before our arrival, recalled Samuel Goudsmit, a nuclear physicist and the leader of the group, some of them leaving sufficient clues in their deserted homes for us to track them down later. This villa was not a home, but the former headquarters of Himmler's Annenerbe Institute. The Alsace group was only vaguely familiar with the Annenerbe's research. Only weeks before had it come to light that through a division called Applied War Research, the Annenerbe had supplied the Luftwaffe and other military services with living victims from concentration camps to be used in human experiments. How Heinrich Himmler used the supernatural and the occult as part of the Nazi war effort was not yet understood by Alsace. Because the activities of this strange academy were shrouded in a mystery that just might have concealed something really important, we needed to make a thorough investigation of the organization, Goudsmit later explained in discussing the Annenerbe. Goudsmit made his way down into the basement of the villa, where he came across a small cache of Annenerbe relics. Remnants of weird Teutonic symbols and rites, he recalled. Strange dummies, which at first looked like the bodies of victims. A corner with a pit of ashes, in which I found the skull of an infant. Had Heinrich Himmler been a practitioner of black magic, Goudsmit wondered, what had been going on here? As macabre and mysterious as these Nazi artifacts were, they did not pose an immediate threat. Alsace was on the move, with more pressing matters to deal with. Huge Nazi weapons caches, including V-2 rockets and chemical weapons like sarin and tabun gas, were being secreted out of the country by the Americans for exploitation back home. For Goudsmit and the Alsace team, the most critical aspect in dealing with a mystery like Annenerbe science was to make sure that the information did not fall into Soviet hands. For what would soon become evident was that as much as the Allies were gathering scientific intelligence, so too were the Soviets. By war's end, the Reich's most treasured and most promising weapons programs had been carted up and transported east into occupied territories like Poland, where they remained out of range of the Allied bombing campaigns. This new competition between Russia and the United States, between East and West, between communism and capitalism, was a contest of one-upmanship. The technique or practice of gaining a feeling of superiority over another. The absolute goal in this Cold War began as a relative one, simply to stay ahead of the new enemy in rank, knowledge, and weapons technology. In 1945, the long-term goal to outperform the Soviets in every action had not yet come to pass. And so, the Annenerbe relics were crated up and sent to U.S. Army headquarters in Frankfurt. Alsace moved on. Immediately after World War II, the governments of both the United States and the USSR began investigating new ways to influence and control human behavior. And here was where Annenerbe science first appeared outside Nazi Germany. Leading the charge in the United States was the newly formed Central Intelligence Agency. One of the CIA's early programs sought to develop a truth serum, an age-old quest that touched upon ideas of magic potions and sorcerer's spells. In concert with U.S. Army scientists at the Army Chemical Center in Edgewood, Maryland, this classified program was first called Bluebird, then Artichoke, and finally MK Ultra. For these and other programs like them, the CIA hired magicians, hypnotists, and even Sybil Leek, Britain's famous white witch. One of the men running these controversial programs for the CIA was Morse Allen, a deception and polygraph expert, promoted to serve as the director of Project Artichoke in 1952. It was Morse Allen's job to search the globe for the most potent drugs in existence so that the agency could exploit them for intelligence use. The Nazis' Annenerbe Institute had begun this kind of research in the concentration camps, pushing human physiology to extremes in order to allow Nazi scientists to measure and monitor results. Now, the CIA and the KGB would conduct similar experiments, each side arguing that the other side's programs required countermeasures to defend against them. In October 1952, Morse Allen learned about a Mexican field mushroom that put humans in an altered state. The fungal growth, called Teonanaka, God's flesh, gave certain sensitive or psychic people supernatural abilities, at least according to ancient Aztec legend. Very early accounts of the ceremonies of some tribes of Mexican Indians show that mushrooms are used to produce hallucinations and to create intoxication in connection with religious festivals, Morse Allen told his program officers in a rare surviving Project Artichoke memo. In some cases, Teonanaka apparently endowed man with the power of divination, the ability to access information about the future or the unknown. In other men, the mushroom acted like a truth serum and made them confess to things against their better judgment or free will. The literature shows that witch doctors or divinators used some types of mushrooms to produce confessions or to locate stolen objects or to predict the future, Morse Allen wrote. In early 1953, the CIA dispatched one of its scientists to Mexico on a hunt to gather samples. But God's flesh was elusive. The mushroom grew in remote canyons, and only in the hot summer months after it rained. The scientist came back empty-handed, but Morse Allen was confident the CIA would ultimately prevail. He instructed his agents to keep searching while he personally traveled to the mushroom capital of America, a farming town in Pennsylvania called Tufkenamum, where he secured a contract with the town's top mushroom grower. Once the CIA had located Teonanaka samples, it planned to mass produce the hallucinogenic mushroom for classified intelligence agency use. The quest for God's flesh was renamed MK-Ultra Subproject 58. 2 years passed without success. Then, in the late summer of 1954, Morse Allen learned that an Army captain at the Army Chemical Center, one of the CIA's military partners in MK-Ultra, was also on the hunt for the hallucinogenic mushroom said to endow men with divinatory powers. His name was Henry Carell Andrea Puharik, and in addition to being an army captain, Puharik was a research scientist, a medical doctor, and a trance state specialist. Since 1947, Dr. Puharik and a well-funded, prize-winning staff of scientists, doctors, and technicians had been conducting a wide range of unusual research at a privately funded facility called the Roundtable Foundation, located in rural Maine. Puharik was also a longtime believer in mental phenomena, even claiming a personal childhood experience with telepathy. When Captain Puharik was called in for a briefing, it came to light that he knew more about magic, mystical, supernatural, and occult research than just about any other scientist living in the United States at the time. Dr. Puharik was granted a higher security clearance and briefed on classified Army Chemical Center efforts to locate drugs that could produce altered states and enhance psychic functioning. Now, with government interest piqued in multiple agencies and the potential of a game-changing drug seemingly close at hand, the real race could begin. Chapter 2. The Puharic Theory. Henry Carell Andrea Puharic was born in Chicago on February 19, 1918, the son of poor Yugoslavian immigrants. His brutal, violent father had come to America as a stowaway. His mother, a housewife, nurtured and protected her only son as best she could. Growing up in the Chicago slums, Andrea worked as a milk delivery boy for Borden's Dairy Farms, and it was in this context that he had his first experience with what he would call extrasensory perception, the ability to perceive things by means other than the five senses. One day, on a milk run, a vicious guard dog cornered him. Fearing that the animal was about to tear him to shreds, Puharic panicked, but there was nowhere to run. "So I sent out feelings of calmness and peace," Puharic later recalled. Remarkably, the dog calmed down, then sat, leading him to believe that mind-to-mind telepathy had stopped the attack. Entranced and empowered by this experience, Puharic vowed to become a medical doctor and solve the biological circumstances behind this mysterious force of nature called ESP. When Puharic was a teenager, his parents divorced, and he and his mother went to live on a farm in Garter, Illinois. There, he worked nights and weekends in the farmers' orchards, driving a mule team and tending to the fruit trees. Puharic was a bright, curious boy, unusually observant, and the natural world cast a spell over him. In plants and animals, he saw deep meaning. Like so many research scientists before him, the natural world was his first laboratory. In high school, Puharic excelled. He served as president of the student council, sang in the glee club, and played quarterback on the varsity football team. When it came time for college, Northwestern University College of the Liberal Arts offered him 3 scholarships to attend. As an undergraduate, he majored in philosophy and pre-medical studies, and then went on to Northwestern's medical school. To earn money, Puharic worked for the university as a tree surgeon, trimming dead branches and plugging holes made by insects. He saw the human nervous system as similar to the root system of a tree, he later wrote. He scoured the works of medieval physicians like Alessandro Benedetti, a pioneer of post-mortem examination, gathering a historical understanding about the science of the brain. And he began developing his own ideas about the biology of the human mind. Why does man think certain thoughts? What is consciousness? What is the difference between the brain and the mind? I would venture to say that nobody really knows another's mind thoroughly, he wrote in his journal in 1942. And I would further venture that very few people really know their own mind. What makes man think certain thoughts, he wondered, from a biological point of view? How does perception work? Does consciousness come from within or from without? And how to explain energy between people? We all know that there are people who can thrill and exhilarate one, and that there are others who simply bore and fatigue one. What, he wondered, was this intangible force? Puharic combed through great works of medicine, literature, and science seeking answers. He could find nothing that satisfied him. It would certainly be a great step forward for mankind if we could sit down and untangle the jungle that is our mind, he wrote. In medical school, he began to explore the biological processes by which a man thinks. "Understanding the nature of man's consciousness," declared Puharic, "is my lifelong quest." Like so many young men of his generation, World War II introduced Puharic to military life. In 1943, while still in medical school, Puharic was commissioned as a second lieutenant in the U.S. Army Medical Corps. A chronic middle ear infection exempted him from being sent overseas to the war. He met and married Virginia "Ginny" Jackson, a War Department secretary and the daughter of a prominent Wisconsin physician. In 1947, he finished his medical degree and began working alongside some of the top medical men in Chicago. His mentor, Dr. Andrew C. Ivey, was one of the most famous physicians in America, having riveted the nation with searing testimony at the Nuremberg doctor's trial in Germany. Puharic did his residency at the Permanente Research Foundation in Oakland, California, publishing numerous papers on the effect of various drugs on the brain. He formulated his first major theory on nerve conduction and an unknown energy force, which he called the Puharic theory. The brain and the nervous system are linked to cells, and instructions in the form of energy flows between them, Puharic wrote. The point that I am trying to establish is that the brain is an area wherein is localized the cell energy of the body. I shall label this cell energy dynamics. Puharic believed this energy force, present in all animals and insects, radiated somewhere on the electromagnetic spectrum, but that man had not yet invented technology to measure or record it. The Puharic theory was embraced by the nation's top doctors, heartily received and critically reviewed. When a few months later, two Yale University scientists, Lloyd H. Beck and Walter S. Miles, first reported that the olfactory nerve of the bee radiated energy in the infrared spectrum, one of Puharic's theories was proved right. And the medical community wanted to hear more of what he had to say. Puharic's own energy was boundless. He was strikingly handsome and charismatic, by all accounts easy to talk to. With his close-cropped black hair and deep-set blue eyes, he looked like Gary Cooper in a lab coat. Women adored him, and men did too. He could engage in conversation the shyest person in the room as easily as he could command the attention of a Nobel laureate. "This was elemental to his character and his charm," said his friends. One night at a party on December 9, 1947, he met Dr. Paul de Cruyff, the legendary microbiologist and author of Microbe Hunters, one of the most popular science books of the day. De Cruyff told Puharic he was keenly interested in the important implications of the Puharic theory and suggested Puharic travel east and deliver it as a lecture to the nation's top physicians and scientists. Over the next few weeks, the two men exchanged a series of letters. In addition to his support, de Cruyff issued a prescient warning. "All creation, including science, is a war against precedent. Science, to be vital, must grow out of competition between individual brains, foils one to the other, each man mad for his own idea." "Conformity was a scientist's death knell," said de Cruyff. "Beware the establishment," he warned. On the advice of his new friend, Puharic traveled east, lecturing on the Puharic theory to colleagues at Harvard and Yale. From the podium, he spoke freely about his ideas, which merged philosophy, mysticism, and science. "What is the nature of the process that enables man to reflect and to reflect upon the universe in a range that now encompasses the phenomena that lie between God on the one hand and nuclear energy on the other?" he asked. Did inspiration, imagination, and Einstein-like thinking come from within, or was initiative an external force? He urged his colleagues to go out into nature and to observe. Watch long trails of birds in migration, the unerring return of the homing pigeon, the struggle of the fish going upstream to spawn, the orderly movement of armies of ants, the pecuniary nature of the bee, he said, for in nature the mysteries of the universe are revealed. As for man, the answer to these many questions, I am convinced, lie in the nature of the nervous system, Puharik declared. A sensitivity to forces, some of which we already know, and most of which are unknown. Puharik's ideas were emerging of medicine and mysticism. I have wondered at the clairvoyance of the mind that can break loose from the shackles of conformity and facts and can give us the philosophy of Plato, the universe of Newton, the spirit of Christ, and the psychological insight of Henry Thoreau, Walt Whitman, William James, and Khalil Gibran. The deep study of this problem is my life's work. Among those in attendance who were enchanted by Puharik's theory and ideas were two wealthy benefactors, Joyce Borden Balakovic and Zlatko Balakovic. Joyce was a primary shareholder of the Borden dairy fortune. Zlatko was a world-renowned, Yugoslavian-born virtuoso violinist who owned one of the world's largest collections of Guarnerius and Stradivarius instruments. The Balakovics took an immediate interest in Puharik and suggested that they work together on a future project. After the Harvard lecture, I accepted an invitation to visit friends in Camden, Maine, Puharik wrote in his journal. The new friends were the Balakovics. Camden was a place unlike anything Andrea Puharik, a boy raised in the Chicago slums and then on a farm, had ever experienced. This magnificent coastal community was a summer colony for an elite group of America's ruling class, children of golden age industrialists who earned their money the old-fashioned way, by inheriting it. Here in Maine, the summer cottages were 10,000 square foot homes with gatehouses, carriage houses, boathouses, and stables. Days were spent yachting. Evenings were passed in wicker chairs on wooden verandas, sipping cocktails, and admiring the environs. Nights were spent in the salon or library discussing ideas, great works of literature, national security, world religions, and in the case of Joyce Borden Balakovic, extrasensory perception. She suggested Puharik create a research laboratory in Maine dedicated to the study of the Puharik theory. She and Zlatko would be happy to donate, she said, and so would many of their friends. To demonstrate, Joyce introduced Puharik to a friend she was certain would also want to become a benefactor, Alice Astor Bouverie. Alice Astor Bouverie was an heiress, a philanthropist, and the only daughter of John Jacob Astor IV of the Astor dynasty. Alice was just 10 years old when her father, one of the richest men in the world, died in the sinking of the RMS Titanic. Astor left his daughter $5 million, roughly $120 million, in 2017. Like Joyce Borden, Alice was interested in ESP and in mental telepathy in particular, a notion she learned about from her father. John Jacob Astor IV was a world-class businessman, investor, and real estate tycoon, but he also wrote science fiction novels about ESP. In A Journey in Other Worlds, A Romance of the Future, published in 1884, Astor's space-traveling protagonists communicated telepathically with one another. "Do tell me how you were able to answer my thought," one character says to another. I see the vibrations of the gray matter of your brain as plainly as the movements of your lips. In fact, I see the thoughts in the embryonic state taking shape, comes the reply. In 1948, Alice Bouverie became the first among many wealthy individuals to personally finance Dr. Puharik's work. Bouverie's initial check was for $106,000, more than $1 million in 2017. With this investment, Puharik started his first research foundation. A third female patron was introduced to the growing circle, Marcella Miller DuPont of the chemical and weapons production conglomerate. Like Joyce Borden and Alice Astor, Marcella DuPont was passionate about ESP and willing to finance Puharik's research efforts in this area. The three wealthy women helped Puharik come up with the name for his new foundation. In homage to the legend of King Arthur, Merlin the Magician, a sword, a stone, and the Holy Grail, it would be called the Roundtable Foundation. At Puharik's Roundtable, there was no chivalric order. Men and women were equals. It was not as much an anti-establishment foundation as it was a secret society of elites. Alice Bouverie became the organization's first vice president. Joyce Borden Balakovic served as treasurer. Marcella DuPont went by the honorary title Mother of Magic. Documents from the Library of Congress, previously unreported, reveal that it was DuPont who first brought the attention of top-tier government officials to the Roundtable Foundation, including Admiral John E. Gingrich, the powerful director of security and intelligence for the Atomic Energy Commission. In a letter to her brother, DuPont wrote, "My great friend, Admiral John Gingrich, is interested in using some of the significant facts for the Navy that will come out of these roundtable experiments." Gingrich served as the Chief of Naval Material Command from 1953 to 1954 and was responsible for all Navy procurement activities. Another Navy man, Rexford Daniels, a Yale PhD, former Lieutenant Commander in Navy Intelligence, and current member of the U.S. Navy Reserve, would stop by for drinks on the porch at the Roundtable Foundation. Daniels, who had a summer home in neighboring Camden, advised military officials on radio frequency and microwave technology, which was still in its infancy in the late 1940s. Rexford Daniels was interested in ESP as a possible means of long-distance communication in submarines. As a member of both the military establishment and the East Coast aristocracy, he would soon become a liaison for Dr. Puharik between these worlds. Money poured in. One wealthy benefactor after the next joined the Roundtable Foundation, including Ruth Forbes Young of the Forbes family of bankers and her husband, Arthur Middleton Young, the Princeton University mathematician, philosopher, cosmologist, and astrologer who famously designed Bell Corporation's first helicopter, the Model 30, in 1942. Congresswoman Frances Payne Bolton, granddaughter of oil man Henry B. Payne and the first woman elected to Congress from Ohio, was a supporter and patron. Henry Belk of the Belk department store fortune came on board, flying up to Maine in his private jet for foundation meetings. Henry Cabot Payne, a Boston Brahmin, became involved, and so did John Jack Hayes Hammond Jr., son of the diplomat and mining magnate John Hayes Hammond Sr., and himself the inventor of the Navy's first torpedo, the Hammond torpedo. In this way, the members of the Roundtable Foundation were a unique mixture of old-money philosophers and scientists, diplomats and weapons designers, poets and mystics. They all had deep pockets and nonconformist ideas. But their common bond began via an interest in extrasensory perception. Was it elemental to human consciousness? a product of nerve conduction, or some other unknown energy force. The quest of the Roundtable Foundation was to conduct experiments to find out and to fund the research that would allow the Puharic theory to advance from conjecture to hypothesis to scientific theory. With the remarkable influx of cash from his new friends and associates, Dr. Andrea Puharic moved his family from California to Maine into a seaside mansion in Glen Cove. Ginny, Puharic's wife, had just given birth to their first child. It was here, starting in 1949, that work began in earnest. Meanwhile, 600 miles to the south in Washington, D.C., the Central Intelligence Agency Act of 1949 was passed, broadening the agency's authority and power. Soon, the civilian pursuits at the Roundtable Foundation and the national security goals of the CIA would entwine. The opulence of Puharic's new home and laboratory facility, called Warrenton Estate, was part of its mystique. The main house was designed by the famous Beaux-Arts architect Stanford White. Warrenton had 45 rooms, 8 fireplaces, and 12 baths. There were wraparound porches, a soaring 3-story entrance, a library, a salon, and a billiard room. From third-floor turrets, guests enjoyed sweeping views of Owl's Head Bay, of seagulls and swans and sailboats on the sea. The 65-acre property featured manicured lawns, boxwood hedges, vegetable and flower gardens. There was a footpath leading from the main house down to a private beach on Penobscot Bay. The adjacent 2-story steepled barn would become home to Puharic's impressive laboratory, where a staff of research assistants worked on experiments relating to the 5 known senses and a quest for the elusive 6th sense. The plan of action at the Roundtable Foundation was to establish itself as a trailblazer in ESP and related research, then garner blue sky research grants from national science foundations, corporations, and the government. Dr. Puharic began conducting experiments involving audio waves and human hearing. The normal threshold for hearing in humans is 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz, but Puharic knew of cases in which certain individuals could hear well beyond that range. Puharic wondered, was there an analogy in ESP? To assist him in this quest, the foundation hired an ear surgeon from New York named Samuel Rosen. Dr. Rosen had a theory that hereditary deafness might be curable if only he could figure out how to redirect certain sound waves in the ear canal. In New York City, Rosen conducted traditional surgeries related to human hearing and the ear canal. During his fellowship at the Roundtable Foundation, he performed experimental surgeries on goats and dogs, with Puharic acting as his assistant. The work was informative, but soon it was time for Dr. Rosen to return to his medical practice in New York. Some months later, during a routine operation on a patient who was legally deaf, Rosen accidentally hit a tiny, stirrup-shaped object called the stapes bone, located in the middle ear. When the surgery was over, a most remarkable thing had happened. The deaf patient could now hear. An accident had changed medical history. To Puharic's eye, this was serendipity at work. This groundbreaking surgical procedure, now called the Rosen-Stapes operation, has since restored hearing to tens of millions of deaf people around the world. For the foundation to be affiliated with Dr. Rosen was a fortuitous milestone. Puharic, though not directly responsible, took credit. Grants from major donors flowed into the Roundtable Foundation, including ones from General Foods Corporation and the Kettering Foundation. The monies, earmarked for traditional research, kept the foundation afloat. Meanwhile, Dr. Puharik's mystical and supernatural beliefs began to deepen. One of the more influential people in his life during this period was Jack Hammond Jr., the wealthy American inventor and ESP advocate who was 20 years Puharik's senior. Hammond held more U.S. patents than any other living American at the time, including a lucrative one for his eponymous torpedo, the first radio-controlled underwater missile in use by the U.S. Navy. The concept was based not on an original idea of Hammond's, but on one from his mentor, the futurist, physicist, and inventor Nikola Tesla. Equally noteworthy was that Tesla had been but one of Jack Hammond's influential mentors decades before. Born into a wealthy family of industrialists and diplomats, and owing to these powerful family connections, Hammond had been mentored by three of the most famous inventors of the 19th century: Thomas Edison, Alexander Graham Bell, and Tesla. Jack Hammond was rich, well-respected, and confident in his mystical and supernatural convictions. He lived in a medieval-style seaside castle in Gloucester, Massachusetts, filled with ancient artifacts collected from around the world. He practiced astrology and mental telepathy and believed in ghosts. And he seamlessly balanced success as a scientific inventor with numerous unorthodox ideas. Over discussions at the Warrington estate, the bond between the men grew. Jack became my mentor, teaching me more subtleties of life than any book can capture, Puharik wrote in his journal. He taught me the art of invention, how all his ideas came to him in dreams, in reveries. Jack Hammond, like Nikola Tesla before him, believed scientific inspiration could come to a man from an unknown energy force in the form of a dream. There was precedent for this idea, including personal accounts from two Nobel laureates and a founding father of modern organic chemistry, August Kekulé. At a science symposium in Germany in 1890, Kekulé, who discovered benzene, revealed that the idea had come to him in a dream in which he imagined a snake eating its own tail, like the ancient symbol of the Ouroboros. In 1920, Frederick G. Banting, an unknown Canadian surgeon at the time, woke up from a dream telling him to surgically ligate, tie up, the pancreas of a diabetic dog in order to stop the flow of nourishment, he later said. The discovery that diabetes could be treated with insulin injections won him the Nobel Prize in Medicine in 1923. Otto Loewi, the German pharmacologist who discovered acetylcholine, a neurotransmitter involved in dreaming, woke up in the middle of a dream, jotted down a few notes on paper, and went back to sleep. Loewi's dream led to the discovery that nerve cell communication is chemical, not electrical, and for this, he won the Nobel Prize in Medicine in 1936. At Warrington in the late 1940s and early 1950s, Puharik and Hammond spent many nights in front of a roaring fire discussing Tesla's theories. Science was about searching and researching, the two men agreed, which is why it was called research. One of Hammond's research ideas was to try to determine whether ESP worked on a kind of mental radio channel transmitted between individuals like radio waves. Tesla, who wrote in his memoirs that he'd experienced extrasensory perception as a child, had originally shared this idea with Hammond, wondering whether ESP might travel on extremely low frequency ELF waves. ELF waves were extraordinarily long, as in thousands of miles long. In nature, ELF waves are generated by thunderstorms, lightning, and natural disturbances in Earth's magnetic field. In an effort to expand on Tesla's ideas, and test them scientifically, Hammond and Puharic built a floor-to-ceiling box made entirely of metal and lined with copper mesh called a Faraday cage. The cage shielded anyone seated inside from all electrostatic and electromagnetic waves except ELF waves. Puharic and Hammond then hired world-famous psychics and tested them inside the cage at Warrenton. They called their psychic experiments Project One. The first psychic hired was Eileen Garrett, an Irish medium famous among the New York City parapsychology set. Garrett came to live at the Roundtable Foundation, and for weeks at a time, Puharic's researchers tested her psychic abilities in and out of the Faraday cage, using a set of five traditional ESP test cards called Zener cards, each with one of five basic symbols: circle, square, wavy lines, cross, star, printed on one side. When inside the cage, Puharic wrote, Ms. Garrett's extrasensory perception was increased by a healthy margin over those scores obtained under ordinary conditions, suggesting electronic shielding had a positive impact on psychic functioning. These results encouraged the scientists to expand their tests at the foundation to include a wide array of psychic phenomena, such as mental telepathy, map dowsing, astrological predictions, and palm reading. Meanwhile, Puharic continued his laboratory experiments with audio waves. He was fascinated by audio aberrations in sane individuals, people who claimed to hear things inside their minds, but who did not otherwise test for psychosis. In search of one of these individuals to use as a test subject, Puharic reached out to his friend and colleague, Warren S. McCullough, who worked with doctors and patients at Bellevue Psychiatric Hospital in New York City. As one of the founders of the cybernetics movement, defined as the science of control and communication in the animal and the machine, McCullough was a powerful establishment scientist and CIA asset. He served as chairman of numerous conferences of the Macy Foundation, a secret funding conduit for the CIA's MKUltra program. It is likely that this work with McCullough regarding audio aberrations placed Puharic on the CIA's radar. Puharic asked McCullough to find him a patient at Bellevue who'd been committed for the first time to the psychiatric ward for hearing voices. McCullough located a machinist whose psychiatric medical profile was completely normal other than a sudden audio aberration. Before the voices appeared, the machinist had displayed no symptoms of insanity. Whereas many a 1950s doctor would have written the man off as crazy, Puharic and his foundation had another theory to pursue. They believed the man might be hearing voices that were traveling on a radio wave, that the machinist was somehow tuned in to a specific radio frequency that other individuals could not hear. We found out that his job was the key to the diagnosis, Puharic wrote. In the machine shop where the man worked, the machinist's daily routine was grinding metal casings against carborundum wheels for hours at a time. At the foundation facility, Puharic's research team gave the man a dental examination, which showed that his metal fillings were coated with carborundum dust, or silicon carbide, a semiconductor. The carborundum behaved like the crystal rectifier in the old crystal radio sets of the 1920s, wrote Puharic. When the subject was placed inside the Faraday cage, all electrical and radio signals were eliminated. We found that his voices ceased, Puharic confirmed. His teeth were cleaned and he was cured of the, quote, psychiatric problem. The man was never crazy to begin with. Rather, we found that he was precisely tuned to radio station WOR in New York City. It was another medical breakthrough for the Roundtable Foundation. The Roundtable's work soon caught the attention of the New York Times. In the summer of 1951, the newspaper dispatched one of its most famous reporters to investigate. Arthur Kroc, a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist and the former Washington bureau chief, was impressed by what he saw at Puharik's foundation. General Foods seeks Puharik's assistance in discovering the physiology of taste, and the Guggenheim Foundation has its eye on other projects, Kroc wrote, lending an air of credibility and intrigue to the secretive organization. Dr. Andrea Puharik was a pragmatic dreamer, Kroc wrote, a true American public servant whose devotion to ideals could be the salvation of governments as well as of men. The secrets he pursues concern extrasensory perception, the tangibles felt by man and beast that cannot be traced to any one of the five senses. It was the fall of 1951, and ESP was being written about in the New York Times without contempt. Even more remarkable, Kroc compared Puharik's quest to that of Louis Pasteur, the French chemist and microbiologist whose contributions to germ theory changed medicine and who discovered the principle of vaccination. Kroc was also the first person on record to reveal that Puharik was working with the U.S. government, specifically with the Navy. At the Pentagon, interest in Dr. Puharik's esoteric work was on the rise. In the summer of 1952, Lieutenant Colonel John B. Jack Stanley of the Army's Office of the Chief of Psychological Warfare traveled to Maine to meet with Puharik. The government's new PSYOPS organization, created only months before, had been designed to counter psychological warfare threats from communist forces working in the Soviet Union, China, and North Korea. Declassified records reveal that Stanley also served as the Army liaison to the CIA. While Puharik may have been anti-establishment in his scientific theories, he was conservative when it came to honoring security agreements with the federal government. All he ever publicly stated about this meeting was that Colonel Stanley was quite interested in a device which we had been developing in order to increase the power of extrasensory perception. Nothing more. But so much more was going on behind closed doors, in black programs and classified projects that would take decades to see the light of day. 3 months later, on November 24, 1952, Puharik traveled to Washington, D.C. to deliver a classified briefing to the members of the Office of the Chief of Psychological Warfare. Then, just 2 weeks after his return to Maine, Puharik received a letter from the Army calling him back into military service. This was a major turning point in the life of Dr. Andrea Puharik. Many of his pursuits at the Roundtable Foundation were esoteric and nonconformist, existing far outside the bounds of scientific oversight or stringent laboratory controls. Beware the establishment, Paul de Kreyf had warned. And yet here now, Puharik was being called back into government service, and there was nothing he or any of his wealthy benefactors could do. The very next week, a strange event occurred, one that Puharik would later attribute to fate, to some kind of a supernatural force beyond his control. With hindsight, it was in this time frame that Dr. Puharik's life took a dangerous turn, one many ESP proponents fall victim to. Cognitive scientists and psychologists call it confirmation bias or my side bias, the tendency to search for, interpret, or favor data that confirms a deeply held pre-existing belief. As Puharik prepared to depart the Roundtable Foundation on Army sabbatical, he traveled to New York City to attend a party for the Irish psychic Eileen Garrett, There, he met a Hindu scholar and mystic named Dr. D.G. Vinod, who was visiting America as part of a lecture series for the Rotary Club. At that time, Vinod surprised me by asking permission to hold my right ring finger at the middle joint with his right thumb and index finger, wrote Puharik. He said that he used this form of contact with a person to read his past and his future. Intrigued, Puharik listened. Dr. Vinod held Puharik's finger this way for about a minute, whistling between his teeth as though he were trying to find a pitch. He leaned back in his chair and for an hour told my life story with utter precision, as though he were reading out of a book. His accuracy about the past was extraordinary, Puharik wrote. Puharik was transfixed, smitten by one of the oldest forms of divination, chiromancy. Whereas knowledge of the future is precognition, knowledge of the past that could not have been learned by normal means is called retrocognition. Puharik vowed to bring Dr. Vinod to the Roundtable Foundation before he returned to the U.S. Army. On December 31, 1952, the two men flew in a small airplane from New York to Maine. They landed in Augusta, where Puharik's administrator, a man named Henry Jackson, picked them up. "We drove over the country roads in the snow," Puharik recalled, chatting all the way. When they arrived at the Warrenton estate, Dr. Vinod entered the great hall of the laboratory without saying a word or even taking off his winter coat. "Hank and I followed him," Puharik later wrote, "and when he sat down, we realized he had gone into a trance." It was New Year's Eve, and the estate's main house was empty. Puharik and Jackson stared at Dr. Vinod, who remained silent, seated, and still. At exactly 9 p.m., a deep, sonorous voice came out of Vinod's mouth, totally unlike his own high-pitched, soft voice with its distinctly Indian accent, wrote Puharik. Jackson and Puharik scribbled notes, eager to create a record of what Vinod said. After 90 minutes of speech, Vinod emerged from his purported trance state, claiming to have no memory of what had just happened. Setting objectivity aside, Puharik decided that Dr. Vinod had channeled a supernatural force. When pressed for a name, Vinod identified the force as a group of entities called the Nine Principles and Forces. Dr. Puharik summoned his wealthy benefactors and asked Dr. Vinod to again lead the group in a seance. Participants included Alice Bouverie, Marcella DuPont, and Ruth Forbes and Arthur M. Young, mathematician, philosopher, and the inventor of the Bell helicopter. During this session, the supernatural force reappeared to discuss a wide array of mystical concepts, Puharik wrote, from ESP and psychokinesis to the possibilities of teleportation and alchemy. The nine entities also referred to Einstein, Jesus, atomic weapons, and cosmic rays. In letters housed at the Library of Congress, Marcella DuPont refers to having participated in this seance with Dr. Vinod. If Puharik's wealthy benefactors saw the Hindu scholar's performance as perhaps something mystical or metaphorical, Puharik took what Dr. Vinod said literally. The experience would begin to obsess him and to shape his research ideas. When Puharik started the Roundtable Foundation in 1949, the premise of the Puharik theory was that a mysterious, unknown energy force existed inside the human nervous system. Now, 3 years later, on the eve of his return to the Army, Puharik had convinced himself that this energy force was something outside the human body, some kind of extraterrestrial intelligence. Puharik had taken the concept of confirmation bias to an irrational extreme. If he were not about to begin 2 decades of work with the Department of Defense and the CIA, Dr. Andrea Puharik could easily be written off as a man of eccentric, illogical ideas. Instead, he was headed on a lecture tour in service of the Pentagon, discussing his hypothesis in a series of classified military and intelligence community briefings throughout America, from Maryland to Texas. He would pursue this hypothesis to the gates of death. Chapter 3. Skeptics, Charlatans, and the U.S. Army. In 1952, with the publication of the book Fads and Fallacies in the Name of Science, science writer Martin Gardner single-handedly jump-started the modern scientific skepticism movement. The skeptics' goal, Gardner declared, was to expose cranks, crackpots, and charlatans in the modern age. Since the bomb exploded over Hiroshima, the prestige of science in the United States has mushroomed like an atomic cloud, Gardner wrote in praise of science. More students than ever before are choosing some branch of science for their careers. Military budgets earmarked for scientific research have never been so fantastically huge. On the downside, he lamented, the less informed general public and untold numbers of middle-aged housewives were falling for pseudoscience, sensational discoveries and quick panaceas. German quasi-science paralleled the rise of Hitler, Gardner warned. Gardner did not mention Dr. Puharik in his book. He had no way of knowing that the Defense Department had hired the neurobiologist to deliver classified lectures on ESP to high-ranking officials at the Pentagon. Instead, the book surveyed a group of popular beliefs parading as science, including the Flat Earth Doctrine of Wilbur Glenn Voliva, the World Ice Theory of Hans Horbiger, and Dianetics by L. Ron Hubbard. The book reintroduced readers to the 18th-century term pseudoscience, originally used to describe alchemy, the magic-based medieval forerunner of chemistry, which Gardner said aptly described a collection of beliefs not based on the scientific method, and therefore not science. Since the 17th century, the scientific method has remained a pillar of research science, a body of techniques used and relied upon for investigating phenomena. There are five basic steps in the scientific method.